The next speaker, it seems almost foolish to try to introduce because there's no one on our program or practically in American psychiatry that is better known than Otto Kernberg. It's upon his shoulders that much of the a conference like this rests. In the late 1960s and early 1970s, he stimulated the first wave of therapeutic optimism and about treatment of borderline personality disorder. And I still remember that when I first met him in, I think it was 1973, he was then, like I, a younger man, and he was out at Menninger's, and the construct of borderline personality was one that was just becoming familiar to the larger mental health world, and he was both supportive and then in some ways a resource for me when I launched my career in terms of encouraging my own work to do descriptive, to refine the description of this disorder. He has spawned many other talented people who have contributed to this field. And it's notable that Frank Yeomans, who was originally going to give this talk, and I both felt that if Otto would be willing, it would be wonderful for him to come, and it was great for you to be here today, Otto. That despite the fact that Frank, who will speak tomorrow, and will be doing conduct the workshop on transference-focused psychotherapy, is one of Otto's most gifted progeny and has taken on the role as the major teacher of transference-focused psychotherapy. And in Otto's career, going back to the time when I first met him, he had at that time been connected with the Menninger Psychotherapy Research Project. And he tried to link his theories about borderline personality organization and its treatment to the research he was doing. And as a leading psychoanalyst and eventually a professor in departments of psychiatry at Cornell and Columbia, he tried to bridge that gap in a way that was pioneering and that very few psychoanalysts either welcomed or supported, of trying to support an empirical approach to psychoanalytic concepts and psychoanalytic treatments at the same time that he was such a leader and a spokesman for the trade guild. There have been, I think, five, might be more, efforts to manualize transference-focused psychotherapy. Otto himself was the lead and maybe only author on the first effort, and then gradually it became different iterations of it as he brought in people with both more scientific and operational skills and people who, like Frank Yeomans, who were able to refine the treatment and train others. It's been a long and heroic process, which has been a major lesson for the field of psychotherapy research and psychoanalysis, and from my point of view, is one of the crowning achievements of Otto's long and in many other ways distinguished career. So Otto, it's a real pleasure to have you here, and I'm grateful for your coming.
Thank you very much, John, for your kind words. And yes, I was with you when I met that great pioneer, Otto Kronberg. I hope he's still alive. I'm glad to introduce to you the director of a group that during the last 30 years has been trying to develop a manualized psychoanalytic-oriented psychotherapy for borderline patients, and in a successive wave of research that has culminated in a randomized controlled trial comparing this approach with MBT and DBT and studying the respective strengths and problems, and developed a replication of that in Germany and Austria that's going to be published soon. We have indeed been trying to bring a scientific approach to this extremely important area, and I'm going to limit myself to the clinical aspects of the approach rather than the theoretical, experimental, scientific aspects of it. I would like to start out giving you a very brief overview of our overall efforts to of classification of the borderline conditions, and developing a theoretical model that we then applied to our treatment approach. We started from the general problem of classification of personality disorders. What are they? Clearly, a big group of frequent disturbances, as you have already heard in what Dr. Gunderson, Dr. Bateman have told you, who lack the normal flexibility and adaptation to their own needs and to interpersonal reality. Within that general failure of flexibility and adaptation, we found two dominant levels, what we call neurotic level of personality organization and borderline level of personality organization. The neurotic level of personality organization really comprises the personality disorders that are most well known classically, the hysterical personality, which by the way was missed in the DSM classification and confused with the histrionic, but that's another story. The hysterical personality, the obsessive compulsive, and the depressive masochistic that got lost temporarily but has been refound in the political maneuvers that characterize this theme in our official classifications, and a more severe level of personality disorders that we call borderline personality organization, and of which the borderline personality disorder in a strict sense is really a key paradigmatic type. So the borderline personality disorder has been our main subject of study, but we have extended it to a number of other ones that have the same general characteristics of severe personality disorders that can be clinically diagnosed, differentiated, and so it's important that you separate clearly the concept of borderline personality organization as a frame for severe personalities in general and borderline personality disorder as the specific one within the field. And the clarification of the differences between these two concepts has done in very clear way by John. Dr. Gunderson has created enormous order in this overall field over the years. Proof of the pudding that all the severe personality disorders have things in common is that most patients have really characteristics of several personality disorders. When you study borderline personality disorder, you find approximately 60% of comorbidity with other personality disorders, particularly the narcissistic, paranoid, histrionic, etc. Finally, we described a level of psychotic level of personality organization, but that's not a personality disorder, but are atypical types of psychosis that can be recognized by a characteristic that I will mention immediately. We found out that, first of all personality disorders are characterized by rigidity of certain character traits. This rigidity may show in a fixed tendency to respond always the same way, or in a chaotic alteration between contradictory ego states. But that contradictory alteration or alternation in their clinical appearance turns out to be rigid as well. We can predict in a borderline patient who one day idealizes us and think we're the greatest therapist of the world, the next week he'll be enraged and will become personification of the devil. So a characterological rigidity is typical for all personality disorders. But a major difference separates the neurotic or higher level from the borderline personality organization, namely the syndrome of identity diffusion. And the syndrome of identity diffusion consists in a lack of integration of the concept of self and lack of integration of the concept of significant others. Lack of integration of the concept of self means that in any particular affective state, particularly intense emotional states, the patient can only experience that state and nothing else, and that's all there is to it, and the world is colored according to that emotional state that goes hand in hand with primitive defensive operations, such as the attribution of a similar emotional state to everybody else by projective mechanisms. And under these conditions, as I think Dr. Batesman would rightly say, mentalization is totally lost. In fact, there is an overlap between the concept of mentalization and identity diffusion, in that the main characteristic of identity diffusion is precisely the loss of capacity to assess from a certain perspective one's own feeling and thinking. There is a lack of cognitive framing of one's emotional state, while at the same time there's a total confusion regarding the surrounding reality of the individual, total loss of mentalization. And by the same token, at that point, there is a loss of the capacity of an integrated view of others, meaning that we have to judge the other person in the light of an emotional state that either the person shows really, or we attribute to him, or a combination. And therefore, it is tinged, it is totally determined by the momentary mental state of the patient. There's an incapacity to understand other people in depth, rather than reading their momentary states as if they were disconnected from each other. The consequences of this condition is that the individual lives in a chronic chaos, lack of capacity of commitment to stable, intimate relations, to work, profession. And on the other hand, lack of capacity for a realistic assessment of others, commitment to other relations, or realistic commitment with the terrible chronic difficulties in the relation with significant others. The syndrome of identity fusion differentiates borderline personality organization, including the borderline personality disorder proper, from neurotic personality organization, where identity is well integrated, although there's characterological rigidity in some areas. Those individuals are capable of perfect mentalization, to the limit of in which all of us lose our capacity under conditions of activation of intense peak affect states. Identity diffusion differentiates neurotic from borderline personality organization, and hand in hand with this goes the predominance of primitive defensive operations, namely an active process of splitting between contradictory ego states, so that loving, enthusiastic, euphoric feelings up and states and relations with others, gratifying, happy relation with others, are totally split from terribly bad, angry, hostile, persecutory relations because of the attribution to others of one's own aggressive, negative feelings that are projected by mechanism of projection and projective identification. And they are related primitive defenses of denial, primitive idealization, devaluation, omnipotent control, in contrast to the classical ego mechanisms of defense, repression, intellectualization, rationalization, that are based upon stable sense of identity and that are not apparent in ordinary diagnostic evaluation of patients, but become apparent in the context of intense psychotherapeutic treatment. All of these patients have good reality testing, meaning that they are not psychotic. They can still recognize the differences in the long run between self and non-self, between internal and external state, recognize ordinary social reality. In contrast to patients with psychotic personality organization, I repeat, not personality disorders, but atypical psychotic patients, who, even if they have zero positive symptoms of psychosis, in a focused mental status examination reveal loss of reality testing, loss of the capacity to differentiate between intrapsychic and external stimuli in a permanent way, loss of capacity to differentiate between self and non-self, and assess realistically social reality. In short, borderline personality organization as a common frame of severe personality disorders shows identity diffusion, primitive defenses, and here it says variable reality testing, in the sense that reality testing is lost during states of intense affect activation, and in general, in addition, there's a loss of the subtle tactfulness in ordinary social interaction, so that borderline patients have a certain loss of that fine sense of social sensibility that you find at the normality and level of neurotic personality organization. Now, so far, an overall descriptive classification of personality disorders that can be tested in diagnostic interviews, that permit to evaluate in relatively few hours presence or absence of the syndrome of identity diffusion, primitive defensive operations, and help classification of personality disorder if you want to in less severe or neurotic and more severe or borderline. In any case, adding a dimensional aspect to our classification system in addition to the categorical one of the DSM system. Underlying theory. Our theoretical basis is psychoanalytic object relations theory that proposes, in essence, that the development of the psychic apparatus occurs in the context of the earliest interactions between baby and mother, baby and caregiver, characterized by the attachment process that Dr. Bateman has described clearly and comprehensively. And that's nowadays a major aspect of research regarding earliest development, as well as the etiology of severe personality disorders, particularly borderline personality disorder. In the interactions between baby and the caretaker occur particularly under the activation of affective states that signal the needs of the organism. And in the affective interaction, a memory system is built up of the self relating to the other under the dominance of a certain affect, so that the basic structure of psychic organization is a dyadic structure of a representation of self interacting with the representation of other within the frame of a dominant affect. And the activation of the attachment system under conditions of uncertainty, pain, fear, organismic disequilibrium takes the form of activation of an intense negative affect with a search for proximity, closeness, gratification, and the function of mother in reflecting the infant's affect, as you have heard, in a congruent yet marked way, determines normalization of the affect state, a tolerable reduction of anxiety in contrast to the loss of congruence or loss of marking that created danger of activating further the intense negative affect with if that is a chronic situation, with a gradual predominance of negative affect states, so that the segment of negative affect experience becomes gradually dominant over the psychic segment of experience of positive experiences. Under conditions of positive experiences, under the conditions of positive experiences, there are internalization of positive dyadic relationships, a representation, let's say, of an ideal mother relating to an ideal child, a happy mother, happy with a happy child, and here two of these relations are signaled, but you have to think of many thousand ones that are independently built up from the negative ones under conditions of stress, predominance of negative affect, suffering, in threatened infant, and frustrating, threatening mother, and again, many of these are built up separately at first, because physiologically there are different systems of activating of negative and positive affects. And these operate completely separate, because at the level of the primary affect activation of the limbic system, at the level of the amygdala, which has a central role in the activation of negative affect, there is no possibility of combination of negative and positive affect. It is only at higher level of limbic and cortical organization, particularly certain aspects of the prefrontal and preorbital cortex, where the possibility of contradictory opposite emotional states occurs, and the toning down of negative by means of positive affect states, so that there's a neurobiological predisposition to that separate organization. But it later on becomes organized symbolically as part of a primitive system in which splitting is the main defensive operation, so that an active psychological process of splitting separates at first negative from positive relations, And only gradually through development as cortical functions develop and as a predominance of positive relationship permit gradual integration, transform this absolute separation into an integrated concept of self in which good and bad self-states can be integrated, modulated, and the more realistic evaluation of self occurs, and the same with the more realistic evaluation of significant others, by implication, normal identity evolves. And that's the normal condition. But under condition when the negative segment predominates strongly, this cannot occur, and a permanent organization is maintained, a rigid maintenance of this separation that precisely characterizes the identity diffusion of borderline personality disorder and other severe personality disorders. The question is, under what conditions does such a pathological organization occur? And we know nowadays that there are genetic and constitutional dispositions to excessive activation of negative affect and lack of cognitive framing and impulse control derived from cognitive framing. In our own research, we have found that a borderline patient, in contrast to controls, not only have a hyperactivity of the amygdala, indicating heightened propensity to activation of negative affect, but a primary inhibition under negative external stimuli, a primary inhibition of the prefrontal and preorbital cortex, which normally contextualizes and brings about the capacity for effortful control of negative affects, so that these patients have a genetic and constitutional disposition to a temperament that has a lower threshold for negative affect activation and a disposition to lack of affect control, to general impulsivity, the first etiological factor. And that interacts with pathological attachment, as you have heard from Dr. Bateman, and particularly chronic insecure attachment characterized by that dynamic of non-congruent, non-marked affective relation between mother and infant, then intensifies further the negative segment of experience, and if on that is added severe infantile and childhood trauma, physical abuse, sexual abuse, chronic witnessing of physical and sexual abuse, a severe family disorganization, particularly with loss of the ordinary generational roles of family, the conditions are created for a strong predominance of the negative segment, permanence of splitting organization, identity fusion, borderline personality disorder that then determines the pathology that's summarized here. This basic conception was strengthened by the psychotherapy research project of the Menninger Foundation, that older generation of work that Dr. Gunderson referred to, that showed that patients with ego weakness, that's predominantly the borderline patient, did not improve well with psychoanalytic treatment, and did not improve well with supportive psychotherapy, but had the best effects of treatment by treatment in which transference analysis was carried out in the sessions, and the patient received as much support as he needed outside the sessions to facilitate the continuation of the treatment. On that basis, we first started to evaluate to what extent we could develop a treatment that would permit analysis of the transference, resolution of the transference, and in that context of identity diffusion, while containing the severe emotional regressions that threaten the frame of the treatment, and developed over the course of 15 years the manual for transference-focused psychotherapy that we then studied, as I mentioned before, and that's the basis of our present treatment geared not only to improve the symptoms of borderline personality disorder, but to bring about fundamental changes in the personality organization of the patients. And in this connection, all our research, including TFP, has dealt with showing improvement of the symptoms that characterize, the positive symptoms characterize borderline personality disorder, and that improve with all the treatments, as you have already heard from Dr. Gunderson. But we have not yet dealt with the personality issues that remain and that after 20, 30 years still show as a relative impoverishment of the life of this patient, lack of commitment, progression, gratification at work and professions, a tendency to remain single, isolated, difficulty in establishing stable relations, intimate relations, family structure. So we still have a very big problem for which long-term research and evaluation of the relationship between treatment and functioning of the personality in total are still necessary. Our assumption about the transference is that the primitive, split-off, idealized and persecutory, all good and all bad, primitive internalized relations of these patients will be activated in the relation with the therapist. And that the tolerance of the activation of these relationships will permit to gradually help the patient first mentalize the experience, mentalize the negative as well as the positive, learn about his emotional state, the state of the therapist, the nature of the interaction, and gradually be able to integrate these opposite mental states, reaching normal modulation of affect, normal internalization of object relation, and normal identity. That's the basic concept. So that what we try to do is to permit the patient to activate these primitive relationships in the therapeutic interaction and gradually to explore and resolve the splitting processes that separate idealized and persecutory ones. So we, in the past 25 years, we developed this treatment, we manualized it, and it was the first effort really to manualize long-term psychoanalytic psychotherapy. And the treatment can be described as implying general strategies of treatment, long-term objectives, tactics, which are tasks in each session, and general techniques that are the typical intervention by which we deal with the development in the treatment situation. First strategy is to define the dominant object relation in the transference. We start out from session one with a patient expressing the typical confusion, anxiety, anger, affect storms, and chaotic communications that as you know are typical for borderline patients. And we try to help the patient to become aware of their emotional view. For example, a patient may feel threatened by a dangerous therapist whom, for reasons that are not clear to the patient, he has to carefully submit to, avoid, protect himself from. And so what we try to do is to help the patient become aware of his dominant fear and his view of the therapist, and try to formulate that in a metaphorical form that seems to do justice to the experience of the patient. For example, in the patient who is frightened and sits in a corner and looks with big eyes to the therapist, who looms as a kind of a dangerous beast ready to devour the patient, it is as if a prisoner who is being who has been trapped, who is being controlled, is at risk of being attacked by a dangerous, rather bad-intentioned person. And we let the patient correct that first metaphorical impression and gradually shift it until it really corresponds to the mental state of the patient. And in this regard, it is it is a typical mentalizing function in the sense of helping the patient become aware of his feeling, what he attributes to the therapist. The therapist may bring in the possibility that it doesn't correspond to how the therapist sees himself, but the patient may reject that completely. Typical in these cases, the relationship tends to get reversed within 10 minutes, within 15 minutes, and all of a sudden that fearful patient may become extremely angry, and the therapist experiences in his countertransference as if he were now trapped by a very dangerous patient. In other words, the situation typically has reversed, and that is a very typical situation in which we again clarify to the patient what is the new nature of the relationship, which is now like a bad person who deserves to be controlled and punished, namely the therapist is faced by somebody who is rightly indignant and tries to control him and tell him what he really should do. And we gradually try to clarify this to a point where the patient can recognize that state in himself. And if at a third stage, at all points, we look at the patient's capacity to tolerate this situation, and then point out to the patient that the roles, they are still in the same relationship, a very bad one, but the roles have been reverted. A very important point that really constitutes a confrontation with something that the patient has experienced and which we use his memory of that immediate situation to actualize, and that is really already a first step in interpreting the transference. Transference-focused psychotherapy is called this way because we interpret the transference from the beginning. And interpretation of the transference means to link the contiguous mental states that are activated, a certain relationship, the same relationship in a role reversal, and eventually, and we do the same in the area of the positive one. And eventually, a third step, we point out to the patient that now, I'll give you a practical example, a woman I've in treatment, and who in a session tells me she's so happy that I'm the first person in her life who is patient with her, who can tolerate that she gets angry and gets mad at me and I don't get mad, and she feels so moved by that and so helped, and the world has changed because I'm really the only and the best person she could imagine in this world. I point out to the patient that I recognize her having that feeling, but at the same time I want to remind her that last week she stormed out telling me that it was a cruel, sadistic bastard, and that she would tell all her family that nobody in his right mind should be in a treatment with a therapist like me. And the patient at that point said, well, but that was a different me. I said, yes. And one problem you have is tolerating that terrible experience, because when you have it, it is as if it were the end of the world. And the only alternative is a very perfect one. As soon as I fail to be perfect, you are right back in that horrible one. So it is the beginning of interpreting splitting operation and the gradual resolution of this basic dissociation. And by the same time, it is both interpretation and completion of mentalization, in the sense that the patient now learns to relate a momentary self state with the general self-states that at that point had not been available to her. That's, in a nutshell, the general strategy. And that may take, what I just have summarized, may take months, although you, and it takes months in the sense of repetitive cycle in which you have to go to this and at the same time observe how the patient's function is outside the sessions. Typically, when everything goes well, the relationship of the patient in the outside improves, while hell breaks loose again and again in the treatment. If that is so, hell in the session, then everything is fine outside, the treatment is going well. If everything is nice and friendly in the session, but hell is going out outside, there are problems in the treatment. And of course, if hell goes out outside and in the session, there are also problems in the treatment. The techniques are derived from psychoanalysis: clarification, confrontation, interpretation. Now, clarification doesn't mean telling to the patient how things are. It means clarifying what is in the patient's mind. It is essentially a mentalizing process. Confrontation consists in tactful pointing out to the patient both nonverbal behavior and those aspects of the patient's experiences that are now not present but are a very important part of the relationship with the therapist when we bridge splitting operation. And interpretation is the general process by which clarification, confrontation, and eventually establishing hypotheses about the reasons for which what all these terrible splitting operations have been going on can be carried out. So interpretation at first has the form of comparing consciously alternative states and eventually reach the point of developing hypotheses about unconscious motivations that derive from the past at the point when the patient has already began to achieve normal identity and is able to look into the processes that in which now repressive processes seem to dominate, replacing healthier forms of functioning by the more primitive ones. we carry out transference analysis and operate from a position of technical neutrality. A technical neutrality does not mean disgruntled indifference, as Freud pointed out, but it means a concerned objectivity in which we try to stay out of the patient's internal conflicts to point out the two sides of the conflicts. This means that we have to look in a consistent way in our countertransference, and particularly analyzing countertransference in terms of concordant identification, in which we feel like the patient, which permits major empathy with the patient's internal state, and other points in which we identify with his object representations while he identifies with his self. A very important part of countertransference activation, in which the patient may be trying to provoke us to get enraged with him and accuses us simultaneously that we get enraged with him, and we do feel indeed enraged with him. He has managed to get us enraged. So we ask ourselves, who am I now enraged with this patient? And this leads to understanding the kind of object representation that is now projected onto us. And we may help the patient see that he is afraid of us or has to get angry because he sees us as very dangerous, hiddenly enraged parental images. So we point out to the patient why he has to behave in certain ways given his perception of us, which we can clarify because of the identification in our own feelings with what the patient is putting into us, so to speak, and so that complementary identification helps to clarify the object relation, and of course it's one step in the reversal of object relation, because there will be a moment later on when that which we experience in ourselves gets activated in the patient, and we may use all of this to point to the reversal of relationship. So countertransference has to be internally tolerated but transformed into material that is used for interpretive purposes. I have described strategy, techniques, and now I'm going to the tactics of everyday intervention. First of all, this is really it's the body of the treatment, in the sense that we have to deal with all the typical complications that these patients show, from severe aggressive behavior outside the session and in the session. In our research, we've had patients who come in with hot tea and throw it on the wall, patients who overturn the furniture. We've had patients who tried to assault the therapist sexually with videotape going, because all the sessions have been videotaped, and these become major issues of patients who show such ongoing rage attacks and affect storms that it raises a question whether this can be contained in the session or not. Patients who develop psychotic regressions and develop hallucinations or delusions regarding the therapist. So for all of this, we have developed multiple techniques described in our manual, which is called the Psychotherapy of Borderline Patients, an Object Relations Approach, and which I didn't see here, but it's available. I only want to talk about the most frequent types of tactics that apply really across the board. First of all, contract setting. Contract are specific arrangement other than the usual one for any patient who starts in a psychotherapeutic treatment to protect the survival of patient, therapist, and treatment, and to eliminate secondary gain of illness. I'll explain. Patients may have symptoms that threaten the continuity of the treatment as well as their life, particularly suicidal and parasuicidal symptoms. We try to differentiate whether the patient is suicidal because of a concurrent depression, and if the suicidal tendencies are corresponding to severity of depression, the depression has to be treated. The first issue is treating of the depression before the personality disorder. If it's suicidal and parasuicidal traits that are not part of a depression but are characterologically based without depression, and very often the mistake is made to think that every patient who is suicidal is depressed, which doesn't correspond to the facts, then we raise a question regarding responsibility of the therapist and responsibility of the patient, certain conditions under which we can treat the patient. Typically, when there's a danger of suicide, we point out to the patient that every time he feels suicidal, he should go to an emergency room or to the hospital, notify us that he's hospitalized, and the treatment will continue either in the hospital or after his discharge. His responsibility is, as soon as he feels suicidal, to decide, can he tolerate that through the next session? The ideal thing would be tolerate it, discuss it in the next session. If he can't, to get hospitalized. That's his responsibility. That's the contract. Doesn't mean that he has to control himself always, but he has the responsibility of either deciding that he can control this until he sees us or to get hospitalized. It's a condition for the treatment. Patients resist that sometimes violently. A patient of mine had 10 sessions of an angry silence because I told the patient I was not going to start the treatment without that understanding. And the patient agreed with the understanding, but was furious and didn't talk to me about 10 sessions before that was resolved. And the way we deal with such a situation is to explain to the patient that it's important that the treatment be restricted to our hours, and therefore it's important that the patient take a responsibility outside the sessions. But at the same time, we interpret his interpretation of the situation as a brutal invasion of his life. It's a sadistic way of controlling him, having him have it our way, and a reasonable sense of rage. And we point out to the patient that the suppression of his suicidal behavior automatically helps him or forces him to direct the aggression that he had directed against himself, against us, because of the perception of this brutality in our behavior. And that typically leads to the analysis of an extremely negative relationship, to which, of course, we contributed by creating that condition for the treatment. And this is obviously acknowledged. But in interpreting its meaning and the experience, in other words, mentalizing the patient under such conditions, permits typically the patient to transform suicidal behavior into a transference reaction. In other words, whatever threatens the boundaries of the treatment is controlled, limited, but followed immediately by interpretive efforts that transform acting out into emotional experience in the hours. And in this connection, again going to countertransference, the therapist acknowledges whatever his expression of countertransference is always honest, but at the same time is honest to the extent that he accepts his own contribution without going overboard to trying to soothe the patient by acting as if it were all his own problem. We try to honestly help the patient see his own aggressive reactions and helping understand where they come from, rather than trying in a supportive way to simply deny the activation of deeper negative impulses in the interaction. So far about contract setting. Control and immediate interpretation. Control alone is no use. Interpretation alone is no use. Our experience has been that we haven't had a single suicidal patient in our research when this technique was followed. I pointed to the issue of secondary gain of illness. Unfortunately, there are now patients, chronic borderline conditions, social support system, SSD, SSI, social support that brings about a secondary advantage of illness, chronic loss of the intention and interest in work, socially supported, that creates a serious complication in the treatment, and we try to reduce those secondary advantages, and it's a prognostically very important issue. Another tactic is to maintain the frame and boundary of treatment. We spell out very clearly what the patient can do and what not in each session. We select, and for example, a patient can yell all he wants to yell as long as it doesn't disturb the work of other people on the same floor of the hospital. We tell the patient, you cannot talk beyond a certain intensity because that disturbs others. If you can't control that, we have to end this session. We'll continue next time. Or if a patient would strip, we would point out that this is not within basically acceptable social behavior in the hour. We stop the hour, start next time, and interpret what has happened in the hour before. Another tactic has to do with what in the chaos of the interactions in each hour and how do we select what we talk about. The borderline patients show typically what Andre Green has called the centrophobic position, in the sense that, of splitting also of the cognitive processes going from one subject to the next, so that in the patient overwhelms you with information and you don't know anymore what's going on where. And at that point, we have the principle that the intervention of the therapist are first determined by what is affectively dominant in the hour. Affective dominance determines the focus of the therapist's intervention. And what is affectively dominant is decided upon, obviously, by what the patient is saying, but not only by what the patient is saying, but by the non-verbal communication and by the countertransference. We combine the information that comes from verbal behavior, non-verbal behavior, countertransference, to decide what's affectively dominant. And if it is not clear in our mind what is affectively dominant, we try to focus what is dominant in the transference situation and bring that up directly. Because if what is affectively dominant is something occurring outside the transference, that of course takes precedent for our intervention. And third, if we don't know what's going on, what's dominant affectively, what's dominant in the transference, we use our countertransference as the guidance of what now has to be focused upon. So that is a tactic that's extremely helpful to orient oneself within each other. But we have to accept the fact that in all treatments, by all therapists, all level of experience, there are times of non-understanding that have to be tolerated. Although, of course, if non-understanding extends itself over several weeks, it is an alarm signal, probably indicating some form of chronic countertransference, another important issue that I don't have time to go into right here. Another tactical principle is to begin all interpretations by common perceptions of reality. We start from surface to depth, but that with the patient and us both recognize. And that sometimes becomes dramatic when we have a patient with a transference psychosis. There was a patient who developed the delusion that I had, it was a physician who developed the delusion that I had forbidden all the nurses of the medical center to get involved with him sexually, and who was ready to beat me up. And once I realized that there was a firm conviction on his part, I told him, and this is the technique that we employ, I believed that he was convinced of this. I was not arguing with him. I accepted his conviction. And I asked him whether he could tolerate that I give him my conviction while assuring me that he would not beat me up. And once, that was a big, powerful man, and I had already brought my glasses into safety. And so after he grudgingly assured me he was not going to beat me up, I told him, I'm as convinced as you are that I've forbidden all the nurses to have sex with you, that this is pure madness, completely crazy. I'm not trying to convince you. I'm just telling you it's my conviction. That's all. Now you may think that either I'm telling you the truth and I'm mad, and or that I'm a liar and I'm denying what I did. If you think that I'm a liar, okay, you tell me, we talk about what it means that your therapist lies to you. But if you believe that what I'm saying is true, but I'm crazy in not being aware of what I'm doing, okay, let's talk about it. And the patient said, no, you're not lying, but you're not, you gave them subtle signals. You don't need to say anything. You just roll your eyes, and the nurses know. I said, I'm totally convinced. I never rolled my eyes, absolutely, totally, as convinced as you are. So don't try to whitewash me, I told him. We have to agree that there's madness in this room. And the only disagreement is where the madness is, in you or in me. But we have no witness. We can't decide that. But we can study the nature of the madness. If you agree, let's study that and let's leave it open, whether you or I are mad in this regard. And that brought about an immediate memory of the patient's father, a physician in a small town in the Midwest, with a kind of an angry temperament. One night his dogs were barking and he got up and cut the vocal cords of his two dogs. And the patient remembered that with a kind of a horror, and it was really, I myself were horrified by it, and it was clear that I was in the position of that castrating, destructive father, symbolically castrating the patient and forbidding him from getting involved with any woman. So this led to the possibility of an interpretation of Oedipal conflicts in a patient in the middle of a severe psychotic regression. This was not a psychotic patient, it was a typical borderline patient. And the technique is that of the management of incompatible reality. It's one further technique. How many minutes do I have? Huh? Zero? Thank you very much.